Last month, I was the guest speaker at a conference that was held in Austria. As a passing comment, not part of anything that had been prepared, I related a news item that I had heard several days earlier, just before leaving the United States for Europe, in which I mentioned that, according to one source, one of the largest voting blocks in the 1996 presidential election is born-again Christians. And when I said that, a man sitting in the back row started to clap loudly and kept clapping. Now, usually when one person claps, somebody else does too. But in this case, he was the only one. And I didn't know whether to say thank you or quite how to respond. And it wasn't until later that I put an analysis to what had happened. For almost all of the people in that particular session were Americans and Canadians. He alone was a Croatian. And I realized that he sought the whole concept of Christians having a say in government as significant being from Croatia in a way that we did not appreciate or understand coming from America. I think it is hard for most of us to imagine not having a voice in our government. It is hard for us to imagine, as hard as we may try, to see what other people have gone through when they have experienced generation after generation of oppressive government about which they could do nothing. No vote, no opportunity for protest, no opportunity for change. And I've begun to wonder, do you think it would be easier and better to be a Christian under those circumstances or under our circumstances? Almost all of the New Testament events took place under difficult and oppressive political circumstances, particularly in Palestine, under a family dynasty, the dynasty of the Herods. They were amazing. On the one hand, they had great accomplishments, and they were revered by many people. On the other hand, their leadership was marked by greed, by intrigue, by incest, by injustice, by what we would consider to be some of the worst of political corruption. It was the Herods who provided the political context for most of the New Testament stories. The birth of Jesus, his early childhood, his public ministry, his death and burial and resurrection, the birth of the church and its phenomenal growth in those early centuries. But you say, wait a minute, what about the Romans? I thought all of this was during the time of Roman rule and under the Roman Empire. Weren't they in charge? Well, yes and no. For the Romans had conquered Jerusalem at the end of a three-month siege in the year 63 BC and ruled for a long time thereafter. It was in 63 BC that the Roman general, Pompey, came into the Holy of Holies in the Jerusalem temple and desecrated it. But on the next day, perhaps with remorse, he requested that the temple be cleansed and reconsecrated and that Jewish religious practices be restored. He followed what was becoming an emerging Roman strategy of rule, and that was to allow home rule and to allow local religion and local customs. In fact, where possible, the Romans would actually allow local politicians to govern the areas that they had conquered. They had many different titles that they gave, and the highest of those titles was the title of king. A person could be a king under the Roman government and have tremendous power, although it wasn't absolute power. For there were required reports back to Rome, and if things did not go well, then those kings could quickly be replaced. It was in this backdrop that Antipater, a man from Jewish heritage, attached himself to Julius Caesar in 48 BC when Julius Caesar, in a battle in Egypt, defeated the Roman general Pompey. Antipater risked his life for Caesar in Egypt, and he was rewarded by Julius Caesar with Roman citizenship, with lifetime exemption from all Roman taxes, and with the title of proconsul over the province of Judea. Antipater gave responsibilities to one of his sons to become the governor of the area called Galilee. That son's name was Herod. Herod was 25 years old when he became the governor of Galilee, and it was the beginning of an astonishing political career that extended for more than 43 years. So much happened, it was so intriguing, that it eclipses modern soap operas and many modern stories as far as the awful things that were done. It's kind of amazing to me that Hollywood has never made a movie out of the life of Herod the Great. Let me just give you a few examples. On the sort of positive side, he was so ruthless in the defeat of his enemies that he did bring peace to his province. People were grateful for that. He was a significant builder. He actually built whole cities. And if people were unwilling to populate them, he would pay people and give remissions from tax in order for them to populate the places that he had built. When his popularity waned, he took a modern political tactic and he cut taxes. Sometimes he would cut them by a third, sometimes by a fourth. Sometimes he would remit taxes for an entire year for certain people. One of his building projects was the temple in Jerusalem, which had earlier been destroyed and was nothing compared to its previous grandeur, built by Solomon. And so he ordered then paid for the rebuilding of the Jerusalem temple. It took so long that it actually extended more than 60 years beyond the life of Herod the Great. But it was a spectacular place. And when we read in the stories of Jesus references to his going to the temple, it was Herod's temple to which he went. The rabbis of his day had a saying. They said, "He who has not seen the temple of Herod has never seen a beautiful building." So he made great contributions. Personally, morally, his life was a mess. He had 10 wives. Not that he was a polygamist and had them all at the same time. When a wife fell into disfavor, he either had her executed or he divorced her, and then he would marry someone else. He had children by most of those wives, sons by most of those wives, and so there was severe competition for who would succeed him as this powerful king. It was his privilege to name his successor as long as the government in Rome would agree to it, and so he named his successor in his will, although he wrote 6 different wills and named different successors in each of his wills. Whenever he suspected anyone of disloyalty or competition, he maneuvered to eliminate them. He distrusted his wives. When he would go away on business trips, he would leave written instructions behind. If he died, they were to be executed. One of his wives, Alexandra, and her son, Aristobulus, one time tried to flee from his terror by hiding in coffins that were being shipped to Egypt. He had his moles that gave him information, and so he found out. They were discovered. Initially, it seemed that he had forgiven them for what they had tried to do, and he invited his son Aristobulus to come to the family retreat in the city of Jericho. They roughhoused in the pool, and he gave instructions to those who were roughhousing with Aristobulus to make sure they held him underwater until he died. And so his own son, by his own order, was executed. When there were changes in the politics of Rome, Herod the Great changed his loyalties astutely and quickly, so that he always tried to stay in favor with whoever was in power. He murdered his friends, he murdered his enemies, he murdered his wives, he murdered his children. And so it is no wonder that shortly before his death, he did what is recorded in Matthew 2, verses 1 through 18. You probably know the story. It begins on page 1497, and it is most often reported as part of the Christmas story. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time that the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. And coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time that he had learned from the Magi. Typical Herod. When he was threatened by a newborn child, even though he was nearing his own death and knew it, he ordered the slaughter of the innocents, the killing of every boy baby in the area of Jerusalem, every boy baby age 2 and under. But what about Joseph? Do you think he did the right thing to try to escape? After all, he could have prayed that God would preserve Jesus and Mary and himself. He could have asked that some of those angels that had showed up in Bethlehem could attack Herod or at least protect the baby Jesus and the Holy Family. But instead, he fled. He became a refugee and escaped the strategies of a jealous dictator, a dictator who was afraid of babies, of one that was born in Bethlehem. I find in that an intriguing Christian principle for politics. It is the principle that sometimes the best reaction is to retreat. That there are some battles that maybe should not be fought. That there are times when we ought not become engaged in the lesser matters so that we can preserve the cause of Jesus Christ for the greater matters. For Jesus had come on a mission to save the world. His destiny was the cross. And so his family was willing, if need be, to become refugees in a distant land on a different continent in order to escape an evil enemy and let one round of the battle go in order to win the greater war. Now, to be sure, that is not a principle for every issue. But it does force us to ask the question, what is really important and what is most important? And I am convinced that as a Christian, I must say that always what is most important is the mission of Jesus Christ, and that I must interpret the good and the bad things that are happening in immediate politics or in business or personal life in terms of how they relate to the greater cause of Jesus Christ. Now, please don't misunderstand. That is not to say that as Christians we should not be engaged in the political arena. To the contrary, I'm convinced that we should be engaged. But we also should be smart enough and godly enough to discern which battles to fight and which battles from which we should walk away. It was not long after this order of Herod's to slaughter the boy babies in and around Bethlehem that he was nearing his own death, and he knew it. He first went to medicinal baths and soaked there with the hope of recovery. When recovery was not forthcoming, he went back to his retreat at Jericho, there to die. He knew the people by then hated him, and he was afraid that they would celebrate his death. And so he issued an order that hundreds of the most popular leaders across his kingdom were to be arrested, rounded up, and brought to Jericho, where they were locked into the hippodrome that Herod had built, leaving the orders that on the day that he died, all of them also were to be executed, guaranteeing that on the day of his death there would be mourning throughout the land. When he was issuing the order, a messenger came from Rome, responding to a request that he had sent earlier to Rome, requesting permission that he execute yet another of his sons, Antipater. Permission was granted from Rome, and even though he knew that his death was only days away, with permission, he ordered another of his sons kill. 5 days before his death, he wrote his sixth and final will, in which he divided up his kingdom between two of his own brothers and another of his sons named Archelaus. If you were to take time to read his biography, you would be offended by almost every page. He was an evil man. But perhaps the most telling line in the biography of Herod is when his biographer says that he was not unusual among the monarchs of his day, and that his behavior by those standards was not uncommon. In other words, Jesus was born into an era of insane political corruption and evil. Herod the Great was succeeded in part by his son Archelaus, another member of the Herod family, the Herod dynasty. He ruled for the next 10 years, and during that time he tried to perpetuate both his father's ruthlessness and his father's building programs. His reign was comparatively short, but it is mentioned again in the biography of Jesus. In Matthew 2:19, we are told that after Herod the Great died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who are trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus, another Herod, was reigning in Judah in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Having been warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and lived in a town called Nazareth. So was fulfilled what was written through the prophets, that he will be called a Nazarene. Once again, God had warned the Holy Family so that Jesus could be protected at all costs. What's interesting is there's no hint that Archelaus even knew about Jesus. His father did so many dastardly things that probably he had never heard about the slaughter of the baby boys in Bethlehem. Nevertheless, every precaution was to be taken, for the mission of Jesus was not to be jeopardized. And so the family of Joseph left their homestead, the place of their history and heritage, and set up a new home in Nazareth. It could be said to be another example of political passivity, no confrontation, getting out of harm's way, recognizing that there was a greater good to be accomplished and to avoid all unnecessary risks. Well, Archelaus alienated just about everybody. Messengers were sent to Rome, and the Roman government decided that his throne should be taken away from him and he should be placed in exile in the south of France. And so that's where he was sent, and that is where he died. He was succeeded in the Herod dynasty by another Herod called Antipas. Antipas ruled Galilee during all of the years of Jesus' public ministry. And so when you read about Herod and the story of Jesus during the time of his miracles and his preaching, it was Herod Antipas that is referred to. In the year AD 29, he did something that political leaders frequently did. He took a trip to Rome. It was necessary to stay in political favor in Rome. It was necessary to pay taxes in Rome. It was necessary to take a lot of trips, not just send messengers. En route to Rome, Herod Antipas stopped and spent a few days at the home of his brother Philip. While there, he lusted for Philip's wife, whose name was Herodias. Herodias was not only the sister-in-law of Antipas, Herodias was also the niece of Antipas. They entered into an adulterous affair. They entered into a conspiracy that when he returned from his trip to Rome, they would each divorce the person to whom they were married and they would marry each other. That would fulfill the lust and the love of Antipas, and it would give Herodias the opportunity to be married to someone who had a higher political rank. What do you think of that? What do you think of a politician who would divorce his wife in order to marry someone else? What do you think of politicians who commit adultery? Next week, the cover story of Newsweek magazine will be on adultery. The reason I know is that twice this past week I received telephone calls and interviews for that article. The reporter asked the question, "What's wrong with adultery?" I answered that adultery, although perceived to be primarily a sexual sin, is secondarily a sexual sin. It is primarily a breach of promise. It is a shattering of vows. It is an affront to God and to the person to whom you are married. After those interviews, I thought to myself, am I really out of sync with what's happening in our country and in our culture? Is that going to appear in that magazine and sound terribly conservative and awfully bizarre? But there was another preacher named John the Baptist who also publicly condemned adultery, specifically the adultery and the divorce and the marriage of King Herod Antipas. The story is on page 1561. It's in Mark 6, verses 17 and following. It tells how Herod himself had given orders to have John the Baptist arrested, and he had him bound and put in prison. He did this because of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, whom he had married. For John had been saying to Herod, "It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife." So Herodias nursed a grudge against John and wanted to kill him. But she was not able to because Herod feared John and protected him, knowing him to be a righteous and holy man. When Herod heard John, he was greatly puzzled. Yet he liked to listen to him. Well, finally, the opportune time came. On his birthday, Herod gave a banquet for his high officials and military commanders and the leading men of Galilee. When the daughter of Herodias came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his dinner guests. The king said to the girl, "Ask me for anything you want, and I will give it to you." And he promised her with an oath, "Whatever you ask, I will give you, up to half my kingdom." So she went out and said to her mother, "What shall I ask for?" "The head of John the Baptist," she answered. At once the girl hurried into the king with the request, "I want you to give me, right now, the head of John the Baptist on a platter." The king was greatly disturbed, but because of his oaths and because of his dinner guests, he did not want to refuse her. So he immediately sent an executioner with orders to bring John's head. The man went, beheaded John in the prison, and brought back his head on a platter. He presented it to the girl, and she gave it to her mother. And there's another political lesson for us. It is the lesson that sometimes we must stand up for what is right and against what is wrong, even if that means unpopularity, even if that means imprisonment or, in John's case, death. That if we are to follow the biblical example, we must clearly know what is right and what is wrong. It is frequently said that we live at a time where that is a blurred distinction. Although I would guess in the heat of every chapter of history, it is a blurred distinction. And so we need to turn to some place or someone to know what is right and wrong in a way that ascends far above the immediate circumstances. And it is for that reason that we turn to the place of the Bible and to the person of God to know what are the standards of what is good and what is bad and what is right and what is wrong, and to choose our convictions and to determine our behavior upon the standards of God rather than upon the fleeting and changing circumstances of our culture and society. Antipas killed John the Baptist just as his father had killed the babies in Bethlehem. That's why it was significant when he later threatened the life of Jesus himself. It's in Luke chapter 13 that Jesus responds to that. It's on page 1621, where Jesus receives a message in verse 31. It was at the time that some Pharisees came to Jesus and said to him, "Leave this place and go somewhere else, because Herod wants to kill you." The reason the threat had to be taken seriously is because this Herod had killed John the Baptist and his father had killed so many before him. Listen to Jesus' reply. "Go tell that fox, I will drive out demons and heal people today and tomorrow, and on the third day I will reach my goal. In any case, I must keep going today and tomorrow and the next day, for surely no prophet can die outside of Jerusalem. Jesus was saying that he was on his way to die. He was on his way to the cross. He was on his way to fulfill the mission for which he had been commissioned and destined. And he was not going to let the threat of any despot stop him. Isn't it interesting that another time he and his family fled to Egypt, and another time they changed their residence and went to Nazareth. Another time they avoided confrontation. But this time he was saying to a king who was a despot, "We will not bend. I won't change my plans for today or tomorrow or the next day. I am going to do exactly what God wants me to do." How significant. How significant for us to understand that God calls us to different responses to different problems and different threats. And how critically important it is then, as Christians, that we have our ears attuned to God to understand what is the right response in those different situations. Well, that was not the last time that the paths of Jesus and Herod Antipas crossed, for they were destined to meet face to face. It was in the final hours of Jesus' life. He was being tried before Pilate. And Pilate was an enemy, a competitor of Herod. They never got along. History reports well the conflicts between them. But Pilate didn't want to deal with the Jesus case, and so he found a way out. He would transfer the case out of his jurisdiction as a Roman governor in Jerusalem to the jurisdiction of King Herod Antipas, who happened to be visiting in Jerusalem, but he was the Roman governor over the province of Galilee, and therefore he could deal with Jesus. And so the face-to-face meeting between Jesus and Herod is recorded in Luke 23, in verses 6 through 12. That on hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he heard that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased. For a long time, he had been wanting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracles. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there vehemently accusing him. And then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him, dressing him in an elegant robe. They sent him back to Pilate. And that day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. I think that day, it was obvious that Herod had met his match. That he could question Jesus, but he could not make him answer. He could say, "Perform some splashy miracle. I'd like to see you change water to wine. How about raising somebody from the dead? Or we could bring in somebody who's sick and you could heal him. Put on a show for us." But no threat, no offer could convince Jesus to misuse the powers that were his. He could not make Jesus do anything that he didn't want to do. He and his colleagues could mock him, put a royal robe around his shoulders, but they could not take his dignity away. For the dignity of Jesus was not in the external circumstances, nor in human behavior outside of him. The dignity of Jesus, the power, the authority, the presence, was on the inside. And so Herod Antipas gave up, discovering that he did not have the moral or political or personal strength to deal with Jesus Christ. And so he sent him back to Pilate. His own life ended not long after that, or at least his reign. He was deposed by the emperor Caligula. And Herod Antipas, like the Herod before him, was sent to the Pyrenees Mountains of France, and it was there that he lived out his life. He was succeeded by another grandson of Herod the Great, this one called Agrippa the First, Agrippa being a name that was given to two of the Herod dynasty. Herod Agrippa followed the evil patterns of his family dynasty. You can read his story in Acts chapter 12, how he persecuted the early Christians. He followed exactly in the train of the Herods before him. He had executed James, one of the great leaders of the Jerusalem church. And there were people who were proponents of Christianity who applauded that decision. And so Herod Agrippa, thinking that that was the way to go, said, well, if you like it when James dies, you'll love it when Peter dies. And so he arrested Peter and put him in prison with the announcement that the next day he would be tried and executed. Never dreaming that God said, stop, and that God himself intervened, not only miraculously setting Peter free, but sending an angel to painfully take away the life of King Herod Agrippa I. And we have another great political and spiritual lesson. The lesson that God will not allow persecution and suffering and even death to stop his message of eternal salvation. That God has determined that the gospel of Jesus Christ and the powerful transformation of lives through his Son will go on. That he is populating heaven, that he is preparing people for eternity, and that he will not allow any earthly politician to stop his plans. Now, I read all this, and I think to myself, well, it may be of passing interest to us. But I have a guess that there are Christians today in China, in the Sudan, in parts of the Middle East, in places where there are hostile anti-Christian governments and leaders that are a match for Herod, who read and reread and memorize these stories and tell them to their children so that their children and other Christians will learn how to behave under the worst of political settings and circumstances, and will tell one another that the Church of Jesus Christ and the faithfulness of Christians has often been better under adversity than in prosperity. And that it is not the circumstance that is to determine a person's faithfulness to Jesus Christ, nor is it the political regime that determines how we are to live, but that we are to follow the path of Jesus Christ and be loyal to him in the fulfillment of his mission of spreading his gospel no matter what. That for us in America, it means that we should be deeply grateful for the privileges that we have, I think far greater than any people have ever had before. And it means that we should take full advantage of what we have, but to do it not so much for our personal gain and comfort, but to do so for the cause of Jesus Christ. And it means that the greatest question in this election year or in any political decision that we make is whether we follow the mind and the mission of Jesus and not the political winds of good and evil. That we are distinctively Christian in our political persuasion and action, and that we are distinctively Christian in the lives that we live, convinced that as Christians, we will trust God and we will do what is right and we will do what is good, regardless of the political circumstances or government around us. It is saying that as Christians, we are for Jesus Christ first and foremost of all, and that we will interpret everything from current events to the personal happenings of our lives in terms of what they mean in our following Jesus Christ as his disciples. Lord, that is a large order for us. But I pray that we will take seriously the message of your word, that we will be so centered upon your Son, that we will be so committed to his mission, that more than anything else, we are followers of him. So if it is in the vote that we cast, or it is how we live in our marriage or how we work at our job, that we will do all in the name and for the sake of Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Usually our faith story on Sunday morning is autobiographical, but this morning it's a little bit different. Kirk Foote comes to tell about the Wooddale Church prison ministry at the Carver County Jail.
As the steel door closed behind me, I felt the knots that had been in my stomach since the night before get even tighter. I asked myself, what am I, a systems analyst for an investment company, doing standing here at the Carver County Jail? In only a few minutes, I would be standing in front of a room full of male and female inmates trying to act normal while leading 1 hour of worship with six other choir members from the Wooddale Choir. Am I insane? An hour and a half after those steel doors closed behind me, we walked out of the jail, feeling not as though we had just ministered to the inmates that we had just worshiped with, but feeling as though they had just ministered to us. I don't think that I had ever felt as insufficient as I did standing in front of that jail room on that cold winter morning. Yet I also have never been in front of a more forgiving group of people as well. My trying to act normal would have been seen through in an instant. I have found that the inmates desire us to be transparent and real with them and enter worship with them rather than to just worship to them. As some of you may remember, last spring there is an inmate at the Carver County Jail that was receiving narcotics from a prison guard. I had heard about it on the news and read about it in the paper, but I had dealt with that news the same way that I deal with the majority of the news that comes in front of me. I had placed it in the back of my mind, and probably it was there to be soon forgotten. To my surprise, after one of our services, in which I felt like I had just given one of the worst talks of my life, a man approached me. He said, "Man, thanks so much for what you shared this morning. It was exactly what I needed to hear." He went on to tell me that he was a man that I had been hearing about in the news, and that he had been placed in solitary confinement, and that the only time that he was released from that solitary confinement was for a weekly Bible study led by two other Wooddalers and for the church on Sunday morning. He told me that through the ministry of the Bible studies that he was starting to realize the unconditional love that Jesus Christ had for him. He then showed me the blisters that he had acquired on his hand from writing each of his family members to explain a transformation that was taking place in his life. Another experience that has made an impact in my life occurred on Father's Day this year. My father was able to drive up from Iowa and join us for our worship service. We had set it up so that my father and I would present a drama during the service. I can guarantee to you that I have little to no acting talent, and that after the conclusion of that little piece, I found that it's genetic, that my father has no acting talent as well. He's no Sean Connery either. The two of us proceeded to stumble through the skit, forgetting lines, leaving uncomfortable pauses, and in the midst of this, looking at each other, knowing that we were thinking the same thing. What are we doing? However, as we finished, with perspiration on our brows, something strange happened. They applauded, and afterwards they thanked us. It is truly amazing how God had taken two unskilled but willing individuals with a faith in Jesus Christ to stand in a jail, and yet somehow he communicated Christ's love through us. The Carver County Jail in Chaska is primarily a holding tank for individuals awaiting trial on a wide variety of charges. It really creates, to many, an openness to the love of Christ. One such man named Tommy had found Christ's love and forgiveness at Carver. He was eager to learn more, but did not have a good Bible to study. Through Wooddale, a study Bible was purchased and given to him. He has since been sentenced and will spend 14 to 15 years in the Stillwater prison. But he has contacted Wooddale and graciously thanked the church for equipping him with what he needs to get through his sentence at Stillwater. In Hebrews chapter 13, verse 11, the author asks us to remember those in prison as if you were their fellow prisoners. Well, I can't say that I am at that point yet, but I do know that even in my shortcomings and naivete, God has been able to use me, as well as many others here at Wooddale, to provide an avenue of Christ's love in a pretty tough place. And I thank God for that. So on a Sunday morning, if you happen to look up into the choir loft here and perhaps notice that a face that you'd seen there before is missing, don't just assume that they're ill or they're at home sleeping in or they're on a business trip or on vacation. Realize that there is a strong possibility that they could be in jail.